Ready to go? All right.
Here's Vinny.
Can't put it on. Good morning, everybody. My name's Vinny. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Vinny.
And this thing says no hands, and you know, I'm so damn defiant, I want to bang it with my head or something. You know? It's just the way it goes, you know. I am very grateful to be invited here to speak, and such a wonderful place, and to meet so many different people that I hadn't known, and get an even wider variety of the fellowships. And I really never connected with so many Al-Anons, and I've been sober 28 years. It's pretty amazing. So, or 27 years, excuse me. So I'll start off with my sobriety date. It's August 13th, 1989, and I have a sponsor who is Roy C., and I have a home group, which is Magnolia Thursday Night. If you're ever in the area, stop by. You're welcome. I am appreciative to this committee and all the people that put this thing on. This is a really nice show. It really is. And this room has such a great vibe to it. It's I don't know if anybody else felt that or if I'm just woo-woo or something this weekend. I don't know. But I feel really good in this room, and I feel the presence. You know, I feel the presence of a higher power. You know, every time I get up here to speak, I kind of get the butterflies for a little bit, you know, and my first sponsor in AA told me that that was God shaking the truth out of me. So we'll go on from there. Hopefully I could tell the truth today. I grew up in a small, congested town in New Jersey. And we were close to New York City, and it was a lot of new Italian immigrants and Irish immigrants, and it was sectioned off. It was very segregated, and we didn't mix with other ethnicities, and they didn't mix with us, and we kind of kept our dividing lines. I was Italian, and my dad was born on the boat on the way to the United States, and so I'm kind of like the first generation American, or he is, but by my grandmother's timing. And so I grew up in a real, real rigid, strict, violent home. And I say that because I think it's important for what happened in my life in years to come. That's all I knew. What I knew was violence, and from an early age, you know, and God bless you, whoever did that. I hope you didn't get any on you. it's good. you know, it was... everything was fists, you know. Nothing was hashed out. It wasn't democratic, let's put it that way. My grandmother beat you quicker than looked at you. And my dad beat you quicker than looked at you. And, you know, I grew up seeing my mom get beat up a lot. And, you know, I went to bed at night really scared, thinking, are we going to all be dead in the morning, or are we going to be alive, you know? And that's just the way it was. I didn't know there was anything wrong with it at the time, you know. So, but what I did know was I didn't feel right, and I never felt right. When I was in kindergarten, you know, I went to Catholic school, and the nun used to beat me. You know, she used to slap me in the mouth because I wrote my letters backwards. And finally, I went home with these fingerprints on my face, and my mom brought me back to the school and told her to never do that again. Now, I can't say later on I didn't deserve it, but I got my ass kicked a lot in school. So I didn't like school very much. Even though I was an A student up until the sixth grade, I disliked school. I didn't like interacting with other kids, even though I had a lot of friends. I always felt as though I didn't fit in. I always felt as though people just let me in their group for the hell of it, you know. They didn't really want me there, but they had to have me there. And so in sixth grade, things started to deteriorate a little bit. But in seventh grade, I found alcohol. And I was 12 years old. And a buddy of mine said, let's get some booze. And he was probably 4'2", and I might have been 4'2½". And I don't think any liquor store would have given us any booze. And we couldn't get in the bar. So we did the most logical thing that a lot of kids did in those days. We got a wino to go into the liquor store for us. And what the wino did was he didn't buy us like we wanted, like a six-pack of beer to split between us. But he bought us what he drank. And that was Vinco Port. And it was 55 cents a pint. And I think it was a drug, because I don't think any grapes ever passed that wine. and man, I'll tell you, it got you to where you want it to be. And, you know, and I took that drink, and, you know, like many people in AA say, and I've heard it many times, everything went away. All that negative stuff from home, it all went away. The nuns, I could give a shit about them, you know. It just relieved me of everything. And so I started off drinking Thunderbird and Muscatel and port wine and things like that. And I didn't know there was good stuff out there, you know, because that's what they got us. So when I was younger, I grew up in Jersey. It was 21 years old to drink in Jersey, but it was 18 years old to drink in New York. And so we used to go over the border a lot when we were 17, because if you had money in the city, and you could belly up to the bar, they'd give you a drink. So we went to these flea bag bars down in the village and a little bit north of the village and drank there every weekend, you know. We also went to these college dances, and we would get drunk and fight, which was my passion. I mean, I had both worlds, you know, the best of both worlds, and I enjoyed it. So that went on for a few years, and then when I was, I had to do 2 ninth grades, because the first one was so disastrous that they sent me to a vocational school. I couldn't be in the mainstream school. I was too unruly for them. And so that's where they put all the bad kids, and they called us juvenile delinquents at the time. And we had little JD cards, they called them. So I had one of them, and I went to this all-boys school. And that ended up working out really well because, you know, we had a lot of shop classes to teach us to go out into the workforce, basically. And so we made things to fight with, like pipes and smoking pipes. And we made a key to this closet so we could go in there and shoot dice and drink. So that's what I majored in high school, dice and drinking. But I knew math because I knew how to figure out odds. You know, so that was a trip. And you know, I was the smartest. My father used to say I was the smartest kid in the dumb class, you know, and I was. So I could get by really easy. I always got by. I always skated by, you know. And when I got out of high school, I hated New Jersey. I hated winter, and I wanted to go to the sunshine. So I went down to South Florida when I was 19 years old and landed in Fort Lauderdale. And some of my buddies were going to college down there. And it was later discredited because it wasn't really a school. It was a place to hang out. But at any rate, I hung out there with them. And And we partied, you know. We did, we chased girls and we played football on the beach and we partied every day and every night. I mean, we stole some things like cigarette machines out of the hotel, you know, so we could get cigarettes and money. And, and you know, we were little capers, but nothing big. And during that time, I failed to say that my father, we lived really poor for a long time. And then my father became involved in organized crime. And I didn't really like it, but I didn't have a say in it. And I always felt awkward about that, especially when people would say, what does your dad do? Well, he carries a gun, and he's going to shoot you if you fuck with him. Excuse my language, you know. And if you don't pay him, it's going to be even really worse. So don't mess around with him, you know. But that's how we ended up making ends meet and getting out of poverty. And I'm not proud of that, but it's just the way it was. And so I saw a whole different lifestyle of people that he hung out with. So, like I said, I moved down to Florida. I don't know if it was trying to get away from everything and thought that all my problems would be resolved if I went to Florida. I think that was part of it. And I was down there having a ball, you know. And then summer came. And in the summertime, it was way back when people left Florida and migrated up to the Northeast because it was too damn hot down there. And so my buddies all left school and went back to New Jersey, and I didn't know what I was going to do because I didn't have enough money to go back up east and nowhere to stay or anything. So I met a girl, and I married her. That's what you do, right? But she was pregnant. So I didn't want to marry her, but I had told my parents, and they said, you're going to marry her. So I didn't have a choice in the matter. So I married her, and we lived together for about a year, and it wasn't good. I wasn't a good father before the kid. I wasn't a good father when the kid came, and I wasn't a good father after the second one came. I was horrible. And basically, I was drunk when my daughter was born. I came to the hospital stinking drunk. And people were like, what the hell's wrong with you? And I'm like, nothing. I'm celebrating the birth of my daughter, you know. And I was an embarrassment. So what happened was I got a wild hair up my butt one night. And I came home and I told my wife I wanted a divorce. And she said, good. She was smart. And she couldn't get far enough away from me. And so we went through that process, which wasn't pretty. She had a better lawyer than me. She outsmarted me, and I thought I was outsmarting her, one of those things. And basically, I was trying to get away with stuff that I shouldn't have gotten away with, and I didn't. And one of the biggest defeats I feel I had in my life was when after my son was born, I left 2 months later. He was only 2 months old when I left. And then I couldn't pay child support, so they were going to throw me in jail for that. And I didn't want to go to jail because I had been in and out of jail for little minor stuff. And so they said they would make a deal with me that this guy who my ex-wife was now going to get married to, and she would, if they were allowed to adopt the kids, then I would be off the hook. And, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but I'm a self-centered alcoholic, and that sounded like a great deal to me, and I took it. But inside my gut, I never really accepted it. I thought I was the biggest shithead on the face of the earth, you know. But I still went through with it. So, you know, it's kind of like drinking against your will. It was making a decision that I knew I would regret later on in life. And I did that because I was selfish. So I got the idea to sell my Volkswagen Bug and get on a Greyhound bus. And that was like the best lifestyle I could have ever wanted at the time. I got on a Greyhound bus and I loved it right from the start. There were people on the back of the bus. If you remember Greyhound buses, they had the last three seats were smoking section, and all the renegades sat back there. Well, I just automatically gravitated to the renegade section. And every time the bus stopped, we'd get more booze. You know, we'd run out to a convenience store or whatever the hell, package store, whatever we could get, and we reload, you know. And so it was like this party across the country, you know. And so the bus driver would put on the brakes and the beer cans would be rolling down the aisle, you know. It's just like crazy. And we had poker games going in the back of the bus. And when I got to Chicago, I met a whole group of people that kind of intersected from the Northeast, from Boston and New York. And the party got better, I got to tell you. It was fun. And I did that three times. So that's how much I liked it. I ended up staying in Utah on that first trip. And while I was in Utah, I stayed in Utah for 3 years, about 3 years. And while I was there, I ended up with a DUI. And I thought I was hip, slick, and cool. And I remember when the cop pulled me out of the car and gave me that stupid test that I don't think I could pass if I was sober. And I actually said that to him. I said, I don't think I could pass this if I was sober. Well, I didn't know I incriminated myself. I was like, I didn't know much about law. And I never said I was a smart alcoholic. You didn't hear that out of me. So I said, how did I do? He said, oh, not too bad. And he put the bracelets on me and said, you're under arrest. I'm like, I thought you said I didn't do too bad. He said, yeah, but you still failed. You're going to jail. And so he put me in jail and I got bailed out. And so I went through that whole process of the court system, getting a DUI. I did a lot of stupid stuff. Let's put it this way. So they gave me like this pre-trial intervention, they called it at the time. And so they sent me to this dude that he pulled out that 22 questions, is it? I don't know. And he started asking me the questions, you know, and I'm lying like hell, you know. And again, I said, how did I do? And he goes, oh, you passed. You're a chronic alcoholic. And I looked at him and I said, your mother's an alcoholic. And he didn't like that very much. So on I went and, you know, I did a lot of stupid stuff. And I told the judge I didn't have any money when I went to court for that thing. And he said, we're going to assign you a public defender, but if I find out you got money, you're going to pay through the nose. And so they assigned me this public defender who didn't do anything for me. He just showed up at court. You know, and so I started yelling at him in the courtroom to do something. I don't care if it was right or wrong. Just say something to that goddamn judge because he's going to throw me behind bars. And so the judge again told me to shut up. He didn't like me very much, this judge. And so then I said, well, I don't think I could get a fair trial from this judge. So I want a trial by jury. All right. And now, mind you, I told you where I was, right? I was in Utah. And everybody, I think every juror was a Mormon who didn't drink. And I was up there for DUI. So again, I wasn't very smart. Needless to say, they convicted me. It took them a while, but they convicted me. And I got a year suspension, which I said was good, because now I could drink all I wanted and I could get rides from my friends. So that was my attitude. They told me I had to go to some AA meetings, and I was like, okay. And so I would drink a couple bottles of beer or cans of beer before I went to the AA meeting. And this is, I'm not proud of this, but this is what I did. And then I would go to the AA meeting, and they would say all the neat things that we say, you know, to newcomers. And they were very nice and courteous toward me. And but I knew I wasn't Stan. I knew I had no interest in going to AA other than getting my license back. And so I would say, yeah. And they would say, you know what? Someday you're going to realize what we're telling you, and you're going to be back, hopefully. And I said, yeah, you probably ain't going to see me again. And I would round up all the weaklings, as I called them, and I would say, let's go to the bar after the AA meeting. So not knowing that, I didn't think, you know, I'm so self-centered. I didn't think that was wrong. I thought that was pretty cool to be sitting in the bar with AA people and drinking and carrying on. So needless to say, I finished that. I was a model probation person. I went through probation with flying colors, passed all my urinalysis, paid my fines, the whole bit. And they said, we're probably never going to see you again, hopefully. And I said, thank you very much. Give me my license back. And I got my license, and I still drove and drank, but never got caught again, and never killed anybody, fortunately. But I had had some bad accidents along the way where things were smudged so that it wouldn't show that I was intoxicated while driving. One time I totaled three cars and a wall where I fell asleep. I passed out in my Volkswagen, and I guess my foot hit the accelerator and hit a parked car, and I bounced off, hit a wall, and bounced back and hit another car. And I was in intensive care for a while, and I had a pretty big headache after that car accident. But it didn't stop me. It didn't stop me. So I started, the alcoholism started progressing, and I got antsy in Utah, and I went to Vegas. That's a good place for a guy like me. They don't have last call. You can drink around the clock, which I really loved. And me and this guy from Jersey that I knew, he was living out there, and so I moved in with him, and we were staying at the Fremont Arms Apartments. I think it turned into a crack house after I left there, and it was a pretty sleazy place. But I had a little job on the Strip at the Sahara Tenon Bar, and couldn't last because I gambled and I drank. So I hitchhiked out of Vegas, and I went to California because it was winter back east, so I didn't want to hitchhike back east. It was too cold. And I went down to California, and I ended up landing in Long Beach, California. And I had never been homeless in my life prior to this, and this was the first time. And I had my blue suitcase, you know, with everything in it, my confirmation and baptism papers and my divorce papers, you know. It was my safety box and everything else in it. And I had my watch that I was given from confirmation. In those days, if you were Catholic, your godfather from confirmation usually gave you a nice watch. That was customary. And I got to L.A. I had no money. No, I got to Long Beach, excuse me. I had no money. And I went to a pawn shop, and I pawned it. And I ended up getting a McDonald's hamburger and a soda out of it. That's all the guy would give me, like $2 or something. I don't know what it was. And I was really bummed out about that. That was the first time in my life I had ever really sunk that low. And I was homeless, and I didn't know what to do. So I went to the police station, and I told them I was going to commit a crime if they didn't find me a place to sleep. And the guy said, oh, that's easy. Go over to the rescue mission. And so then I started a new level of alcoholism, what I call alcoholism. And I started staying in the rescue missions and living on the streets and things like that, which I thought I'd never do. And I worked for, because it was like $17 a week or something, or $10 a week to live in this dormitory style place. And so I worked in day labor, which a lot of alcoholics end up doing. And I had great jobs in day labor. I worked in one place where I pushed a broom around a machine shop for 8 hours. I loved it. It was the best job I ever had, I thought, at the time, because I didn't have to think. I didn't have to do anything. I was lazy, you know. I had another job where I got one rubber glove and put the other rubber glove to it and put a rubber band around it all day and threw them in a box. I was like, this is awesome. This is great work, you know. And they paid me $17 a day. I almost put my hands on the thing. They paid me $17 a day in a voucher. I'd cash it at the bar. I'd drink 10 of it and put 7 away for rent. And that's the way my life went for a little while. And then I got antsy again. So I was one of those drunks that traveled. I like to travel, you know. I called that my California tour. So I ended up going down to San Diego. But before that, I found the bus system, which I could go for the on the bus. It was only 25 cents in those days. And I could ride this RTD. It was called Rapid Transit something department. And I could ride all the way down to the end of Orange County and see all these beautiful beaches. And I thought I was living the life, you know, and I could panhandle along the way. And in these different beaches, and I could have lunch in, what do you call it? I could have lunch in Huntington Beach, or I could have lunch in Laguna Beach, you know, or whatever. And I would panhandle and just hang out in these places all day long. And then go back to my room at the flop, you know, and that was my life until I got antsy again, and I went to San Diego. And in San Diego in those days, it was all strip bars downtown and little sleazy bars, and I loved that. I mean, I haven't yet met an alcoholic who didn't love a sleazy strip joint or a hooker. So that was my life for a while, and I would panhandle enough money to go into the bars and hang out and then go sleep in the rescue mission. And then, it's pretty lengthy, I ended up turning around and going up the coast to Santa Barbara and on to San Francisco, where I landed for a while. And in San Francisco, I lived on the streets for a while. I slept in what is now called the Soma. This is a pretty interesting contrast for me because I slept in these, they used to be like warehouses in the Soma, if you know anything about San Francisco, south of Market. They didn't even call it that in those days. And I would sleep in the doorways there in a sleeping bag. And then later on in life, I had a friend of mine that I went to bring his kid down to Santa Cruz, and we went up to San Francisco, and I stayed in a $2 million loft in the Soma. So there's not sober, sober, you know, which way is better, you know? And I was driving this guy's Range Rover around San Francisco. I'm like, okay. But at any rate, I stayed in San Francisco for a while. I mean, I think I was there like 3 years. And during the time I was there, I ended up landing a job in a hotel where they gave you room and board. And that was ideal for a guy like me because then I ran little errands. It was for senior citizens, this hotel, like I am today, right? And I would run errands for them, and they would give me tips. And so I had enough dough in my pocket, and I landed a job at the Hyatt Regency as a busboy. And so I had money coming in, and I didn't have to pay room and board. And I had everything that I needed, you know? And I really loved it a lot, but I just couldn't get my shit together. You know, I just couldn't get my shit together. I did a lot of crazy things in San Francisco. And I remember one night, this gal that worked with me, had asked me if I wanted to go to Hawaii. And I said, everybody wants to go to Hawaii. Who doesn't want to go to Hawaii? And she said she had money for tickets. And I had been doing something that makes you hallucinate. I'm not going to talk about my drugs up here, but did something that makes you hallucinate. And said, that sounds good. I was on the airplane, and I came out of a blackout, and there was Don Ho music kind of on the sound system on the plane, and this stewardess in a with a lei and a flowered dress, and I'm like, where the hell am I? I'm like, and this gal sitting next to me, and she goes, don't you remember we're going to Hawaii? I'm like, oh, shit. And we only had a one-way ticket. One-way ticket, right? So what would happen is I pissed her off. She left me. I had no return ticket, and I was stuck on the island of Maui with no way to get back to the mainland. And so I hated Hawaii. And excuse me, at that time, they had sections of parks where you could camp, but you had to go get a registration kind of thing. And I had no registration. I had no money for the registration thing. And I met this old hippie guy that lived on the beach. And he gave me boiled brown rice, which I will never eat again in my life, and seaweed, which I will never eat again in my life, and macadamia nuts, which I will never eat again in my life, hopefully. And that's how I lived for a while. My friends back in the mainland wrote a bad check so to the airlines. That was in the days where they didn't push it through a machine like they do now. And so they wrote a bad check to the airlines and got me a ticket home after 6 months. So I lived on the beaches and parks for 6 months. I came back to San Francisco and called it quits. I went up to Lake Tahoe, but I still had a gambling addiction as well, and I couldn't make it there. I ended up going back east again to South Florida and got in a lot of trouble in South Florida. And I'm going to fast forward this so I could get into recovery. But at any rate, I was in South Florida for a bunch. And I started working in a country club, and I would travel between there and New England in the summer and Florida in the winter. And that was a good gig for an alcoholic like me. Again, I got room and board, and I had access to booze because I was the bar manager, so that was good. And then so I drank all their booze all summer, and winter was a little bit tougher. They had tighter restraints on us. But that went on for some years. And then finally, I crashed and burned for hopefully the last time. In 1989, I was really drunk, and I was hungover. Not hungover, I was detoxing. I didn't know about detoxification, but I'll get into that. And I was really hungover. And I had a case of warm Michelob, which you guys are going to think I was a high bottom because I had Michelob. I didn't have Milwaukee's finest. I had Michelob. And I was drinking that warm Michelob, and I got the idea that I needed some help, that I was going crazy. So I called the psychiatric hospital, and I had just worked enough so that I had insurance, medical insurance. And so they asked me about, you know, my medical insurance. I gave them my card. This was all in a blackout. And they called me. They said, okay, we're going to check it. We'll call you back. They called me back, and I only know this because they told me about this whole interaction. And they called me back, and they said, your insurance is good, come right over. And I had this car that I had borrowed from my friend. It had dents all over it, bad tags, ran out of gas all the time. So I ran out of gas on the way to the psychiatric facility. But before that, they called me back and they said, you were accepted, you know, you could come right over. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they're like, well, you called us and asked us for some psychiatric help. I'm like, I didn't call you. And they said, oh, yeah, you did. So I said, the hell with it. I'll take a vacation. You know, I need a little time off the, you know, off this booze and drugs and shit. And so I went and I got there and there were a lot of people in the waiting room and they shuffled me into this room and then took me in into a unit, a psychiatric unit. And the next day they said, you're not mentally ill. You're an alcoholic. And I said, I know I'm an alcoholic. I mean, you don't have to tell me that. And so they said, well, do you want to go to our treatment unit? And so they brought me to the treatment unit. I agreed. But I didn't know it was a locked facility. And so I was locked in. And I was trying. I was banging on the doors trying to get out. And it wasn't working. And they sent a psychiatrist to see me. And I said, you better get me the hell out of here. You guys got a mistake here. You can't lock me up. He said, look, you could do it the easy way or the hard way. You know, you could listen to what I say right now to you, or I could bring you to court, and I will tell you when you leave this place. And I said, well, I think I better listen to you. And just a little bit after that, I went into DTs. And thank God I was in that facility because they saved my life. I didn't know what was going on with me. I was hallucinating, and I knew I didn't take any drugs. And, I mean, I had just drank, but I guess I didn't drink soon enough in between drinks. And I needed medical treatment. And they had medical treatment there. So I was really fortunate. And there was this guy who was one of the drug counselors, and his name was Steve Clady. And Steve was rubbing my back and saying, we love you. And don't worry, bud, you're going to get better. As I was puking and shitting myself and just awful, awful physical stuff happening to me. And I couldn't understand it. And he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a counselor. And he had told me all about AA. And he said, man, it's the best thing that ever happened in my life. And I can't tell you enough about it. And I just couldn't believe that he was so nice. And the irony of that story is, Steve cut his throat in a park. A year later, he committed suicide because he drank again. And that really crushed me at the time. But later on, I understood that that's what happens a lot of times to alcoholics. So there was this other guy, this big, tough Italian guy named Pete. And Pete was like, he wouldn't talk to you. He'd just walk away from you. You know, he'd say something and walk away. And, you know, like, shut up and listen. And then he'd walk away, you know. You're an asshole. You know, things like that. And he was a real sweet guy. I loved him to death. And then they had a lady they called the Barracuda. And she put you in the middle of the group, and, you know, you had to bear your soul out there. And it was just a scary place. But at any rate, it helped me. I stayed there for 23 days, and then they kicked me out because I had no more insurance and sent me to a halfway house. And the halfway house was for indigent men, and it cost $100 a week. And if you didn't have your $100, they kicked you out. And so I got a little job working in a Holiday Inn, and for breakfast. I couldn't work any dinners anymore. They didn't trust me. And I had enough money for a carton of cigarettes and to pay my $100. And I stayed in that halfway house for 5 months. And the guys that worked in the halfway house were all in AA. They all were like 15, 18 years sober, most of them. And the director was like almost 30 years sober at the time. and they called him Leatherneck Tom. And so Leatherneck Tom was like, if you don't go to AA, you don't live here. You know, it's that cut and dry. And if you don't listen to our rules, out the door. And, you know, I was unruly. I mean, and they made you make your bed, you know, and they made you clean your room. And, I lived like an animal before I got there. You know, my life was not organized in any manner, any sense of the word. And so Tom taught me a lot, needless to say, and so did all the other guys that worked in that house. But the rule was, if you wanted a pass, you had to be there 30 days, and you had to have a sponsor, and you had to have a home group. And so I right away got a sponsor, and I got a home group from my sponsor. But I didn't have the ability to read when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and this was something that I was really ashamed of, that I couldn't focus lines. I couldn't. My attention span was like that of probably a two-year-old. And I met this guy at this meeting one night, and I had been eyeballing him, you know. And, you know, I was at that stage where, I can't ask him. I'm scared to ask him and stuff like that. And I don't want to share with another guy any of my shit, you know. And so finally I got up enough courage to ask him, and he said, yeah. And that guy was amazing to me. He came to the halfway house every Monday night, and he read the big book to me, and until I could read again. And he took me through the steps, and then he had been not going to meetings, and his program kind of went to hell. It's none of my business, but unfortunately, he went back out and drank again. And so I had to find another sponsor. But before that, I spent these 5 months in the halfway house, and I went to meetings. If you were in a halfway house and you were not working, you went to a meeting in the morning, you went to a noon meeting, you went to an early evening meeting before dinner, like a 4 o'clock or a 5 o'clock, and you went to a night meeting. So you went to 4 meetings a day, whether you liked it or not. And I sat in the back of the room, and I pouted like a little kid, and I would say to myself, this is bullshit, but I never had the courage to say anything to anybody. And, you know, like we used to say, through osmosis, something happened. You know, I don't know. All of a sudden, little but little, I became more approachable, and I became a nicer guy, and things started happening to me, and I was accepting of people hugging me. I didn't like people touching me when I first came in here, and they were all wanting to hug me. I hated that. And then I started becoming little by little. I remember one time walking out of a meeting because this lady got up. She was from Boca Raton, Florida. I don't know if you know anything about Florida, but she was from a hoity-toity neighborhood. And she said, my maid found 2 bottles of vodka in my garbage. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't had a drink since. And I was like, that's the saddest fucking story I've ever heard in my life. You know? Like, I wanted to spit. I was so mad. I was so angry. So angry. Like, are you kidding me? I spilled more on my friggin' shirt than you drank, lady. Jesus Christ. You know, I really got upset over that. I don't know why I got upset, but I got upset. And so, I go off track a little. So, slowly but surely, I started getting sober, you know. And before I knew it, it was a year. Ooh, that's a long time. But at a year, I felt like I was going nowhere. I felt bored. I felt, I don't know. I felt like it wasn't working like it was in the beginning. And so by that time, I had a new sponsor and started going through the steps again. And that was a gift. Now I got to tell you, that sponsor started getting squirrely, and he started cheating on his wife. And I was thinking to myself, I don't know if this is the way we're supposed to behave in AA. And he stole all his parents' money that they had saved all their lives. And so he relapsed. You know, he went back out again. And so I had to find another guy to sponsor me. But at that time, I said to myself, I ain't letting another guy into my world. I'm not going to do that again. I've had enough, you know. And if you're out there and you're new and you've thought of this, it was like, damn, am I the only one doing this shit? You know, is this a big bullshit session? You know, are they sitting back in a room somewhere laughing at me saying, you're the only guy doing this shit, that stupid ass? You know, that's how I felt. And but a friend of mine, a gal in the program, said, why don't you get John? And I said, John, I hate fucking John. I can't stand that guy. He's such an arrogant asshole. You know, and needless to say, I got John as a sponsor, and he was the most wonderful, kind, loving man I've ever met in my life. He was older than I was, a lot older than I was, and he was like the father I never had. And I know it's AA, and it's, you know, sponsorship relationship, but he gave me more. He gave me so much more. And he opened up the doors for me to the new freedom and the new happiness that I never knew. And we went through the steps. And so we had a great relationship. But he was a tough old coot. He said, if you want me to sponsor you, you meet me at 7 a.m. Sunday morning at the meeting. If you're 1 minute late, you might as well see me next week, because I ain't going to work with you that week. And he really held my feet to the fire, and I needed it. It wasn't that he was, you know, arrogant or stubborn or any of that. He knew that I needed that. I needed that discipline to be on time. He taught me so many things about life that I'll never be able to pay back what I got. And then later on, I decided to move out of Florida, and I got what else would make you move but a woman, right? I was living down there, and one of my best buddy up in New Jersey asked me to help his sister, who was on the streets smoking crack and hooking and all that shit. And so I brought her down to Florida with me, and I had friends, because by then I had gone back to school, and I got a degree in social work. At first I got a degree from the community college, then I went on to get a bachelor's degree and on to get a master's degree. And I never thought I could do that. The people in AA took me by the hand to the community college and helped me fill out the registration form. I was scared shitless, but I was this tough guy that I couldn't let anybody know that. I was scared shitless that I could be able to fill out an application for college, you know. But at any rate, I did, and I graduated and did all the things that I needed to do to obtain a master's degree in social work. And I worked with kids out in the Everglades, impoverished kids out in the Everglades, and who had these horrific lives. But at any rate, I helped my buddy get his sister into treatment, because I had a buddy that was running a treatment center, and she did well, and she went on to a halfway house, and then she, like Jim or Fred, thought it would be a good idea to go to the beach and meet a guy and have a beer, and it was all over from there. Afterward, after my now wife came down to visit her, she was drunk when she came down to visit her, and then for some unknown reason, we hooked up and got together, And so we were having this long-distance relationship between Florida and Seattle. And I got tired of flying, and so did she. And so we ended up moving in together. I moved out to Seattle in 2001. And I got to say a little bit about that, too. But at any rate, we ended up getting married, but there were a lot of struggles there, a lot of struggles. I ended up by myself for 10 months and, you know, kicking myself in the ass. Why the hell did I chase after a woman when I was 12 years sober, only to be alone again, you know, in Seattle, where I knew nobody. And so it all panned out. I had a buddy of mine, Terry T., that took me around all the meetings and showed me the good meetings, and I got a sponsor, and the rest is history. But I really took a liking to Seattle. You know, it's a pretty cool place. It's not flat like Florida. <It's>, I don't like climbing the hills, but they're pretty. But at any rate, I really like it out here. And I found AA just as well as I found AA in South Florida. And I have a great sponsor who I love dearly and a bunch of guys. So now I'm retired, semi kind of retired. And what I found was it opened up another door in my sobriety, because now I have all the time in the world to sponsor guys, to go to meetings, to help out at meetings, to be really active in the program. And I remember over the years, I've been sober, like I say, 27 years is a long time. People saying, you know, the more active you are, the better you're going to feel. And it's very true. I'm here to tell you that it's very, very true. I meet a guy every day, a different guy every day of the week. And I am so grateful for that. You know, I'm not a guru. I'm none of that shit, you know. But what I do is I meet a guy every day. We usually read out of the big book. You know, we're usually working on a step. Or we're just shooting the shit, you know, talking about how we're going to fix the problems of the world or or not. And also talking about our problems, you know. And it's such a refreshing experience to be able to talk to another man openly and honestly about yourself. I mean, I don't know about anybody else in here. What I learned in AA is I have a big ego, and I'm going to lie to you before I'll tell you the truth about what's really wrong with me, because I don't want to let you know. I don't want to feel incompetent. I don't want to feel lesser than. I've always felt that, you know. So now it's a huge opening for me. Like I say, every day I got somebody new or old. I mean, I have a guy that's, how old is he now? 87 years old that I sponsor, and he's 2 years sober. And that is a treat. The treat, that guy's life has changed so much in these 2 years. And he's so grateful to me, and he has one leg. And I pick him up every Monday, you know, and I take him to a meeting, and then we go back to the old people's home, and we read the big book, and we have lunch, you know, like we're at the country club, you know. It's wonderful. So I don't know if there's anything I could say, you know, from the podium today is being active is a wonderful thing. Being active is a wonderful thing. I'm really grateful for this retreat, because I have never been around any that I know of. Well, I got to think about it, but Al-Anon guys, and that's been a treat to be around Al-Anon guys and hear the other approach, you know, because for me, I have those characteristics. I have those traits. I know it. I'm not stupid. I mean, I know they're there, but you know, do I want to do anything about them, you know? And when the pain gets bad enough, I think I'll do something about it. That's how I always work, you know? So there's a lot of double winners in here, and there's a lot of straight Al-Anon guys in here that I know can help very much with relationships, with what it's like to be on the other side of this shit, you know? If I were treated the way I treated other people, it wouldn't be good. I would be one angry dude. I could tell you that. So, but we're fortunate enough to have programs that work for that, you know, and it's simple. Like I was listening to a couple meetings and all I could think of is simplicity, you know. The spiritual component for me is I asked what I was told right in the beginning. I asked my higher power to keep me away from a drink and to be a good person in the morning. And at night, I say thank you. And I can't make it more complex than that because I start thinking it's Santa Claus and I start asking for shit. I want a BMW, you know. I don't want to drive a Subaru. I want a BMW, you know. But so that's what I was taught when I first came in. Don't drink, go to meetings, clean house, help others. Thanks for letting me share.